Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'm really glad to have my guest co-host again this week. While Christy is out, Dr. Kiona Gullett, one of our fabulous residents at UNC Family Medicine. Welcome, Kiona.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And on our show today, Kiona, we're going to be talking with Dr. Scott Lawrence, assistant professor at UNC's Department of Ophthalmology and director of the Ophthalmology Glaucoma Service there, about glaucoma and preventing blindness. I'm really interested in this topic.
I am too, and I'm sure I can learn a lot of information that I can bring back from my grandparents even.
I know they're eager. Inside track there. Yeah, there's some relatives on my side that will be interested as well. But first, we've got some interesting research that matters today. We're going to be able to talk about peak exercise heart rate for men and women.
We're also going to talk about bariatric surgery and how that decreases the risk of uterine cancer.
We're going to talk about salt intake and ways of adjusting it, maybe through learning about spices.
We're also going to talk about how diabetes, getting it in the middle age, connects to memory loss.
Well, we're really kind of diverse issues today. Let's talk about this very first one, which is exercising and heart rate. Kiona, do you check your pulse rate when you exercise? Do you ever do that?
You know, I didn't used to do that, Adam, until I had a physical trainer actually show me how important it was. And now when I feel like I'm in my target zone, I actually do check it. Whether or not, like, I'm right where I should be, that's another problem for another day.
a lot of us. And, you know, I didn't used to do as much. And then one day I felt really lightheaded after exercising, and I really pushed myself really hard. My heart rate was like, you know, 165. Mm-hmm. And I said, ooh, I think that's a little high. And the question was, well, what should be our heart rate when we exercise? And what has been kind of the standard has been, well, 220 minus your age. And that's what was taught with me. But there's now some research or suggestions that that's not the right way of going.
Yeah, and I actually found this article interesting. And I think the researcher commented on how that 220 minus your age was based in data that was 40 years ago.
Wow.
You know, and we're still kind of using that system now. And I think the new guidelines are that women age 40 to 89, they should be using 200 minus 67% of their age. And for men, 216 minus 93% of their age. So they are showing that there's some differences in the target heart rate, both for men and women and in the various age groups.
And these are the maximum heart rate.
Maximum heart rate.
So if you were 50 and you were a woman, then that would imply about 170 is your maximum heart rate. And if you want to go to 80% of your maximum heart rate, you know, that would be somewhere around 120 to 130. Mm-hmm. And again, for men, it might be a little bit more than that. And this was based on results of 25,000 stress results from stress testing at the Mayo Clinic. And I think this will modify, and we'll start to hear some more advice, which recognizes the difference between men and women and perhaps what we could do and stay safe.
Yes, and I think that's kind of where medicine is going, is kind of tailoring your care, and this is really getting at this.
Speaking of tailoring care, our next research that matters, Christy and I, Kiana, I'm sure you know and you see it a lot, we talk a lot about obesity and morbid obesity and those body mass indexes that are 30, 35, 40, and that bariatric or surgery to actually limit what one can eat that leads to weight loss is a really good option for some people. And this looks at bariatric surgery and cancer.
Yeah, which is a connection that, you know, honestly not the first thing that comes to your mind, because you're thinking about preventing heart disease, thinking about preventing diabetes, and we don't really think about the cancer risk associated with it. But having a large amount of fat tissue does increase your risk of uterine cancer due to the hormone changes that happen. And I think this data was saying that with a reduction in severe obesity, you decreases your chances of uterine cancer by 70%.
Wow.
You maintain your normal weight after bariatric surgery.
Wow, that's amazing. This was a research that was in the journal Gynecologic Oncology. and they were looking at over 7 million patients, of which 103,000 had had bariatric surgery and 44,000 had a diagnosis of this uterine cancer. And the reduction of the types of things that lead to estrogen production and the insulin resistance associated with excess weight, pretty amazing. And I think, again, it's something we underutilize, underthink about for some people for whom this would really be life-saving.
Very much so. Very much so.
Let's put a link up to that on our website and ask our health sciences librarians to make sure that that's available. But let's talk about our next research that matters, Keona, about how to reduce salt intake and maybe some different ways of doing it. And I'm sometimes aware that I think I eat too much salt. I think most Americans do, particularly like things like potato chips and things like that.
Well, Adam, we're also Southerners, so
we're native Southerners. Uh-oh, you're going there.
My Sunday dinners, you know, do consist of mac and cheese and collard greens and all the things that I know I'm not supposed to eat. And I think this article, what I think is really nice is that they tie in how to manage your salt intake but not take away from your traditional foods.
I
think that's something that, you know, we can easily say reduce your salt intake, but, you know, people come from various backgrounds, are used to eating their traditional foods. They enjoy them. We don't want to say don't enjoy your food, like the things that make you happy.
Right. And you may not stay with the diet. And this was research that was actually presented recently at the American Heart Association's one of their scientific sessions. And they had a couple different phases of the study where these volunteers would eat a low-sodium diet for a month, and they certainly could decrease their sodium intake in their diet. And then a different phase, they had the patients either do this spices and herbs as an alternative to that, or just say keep that low-sodium diet. And those who went on those spices and herbs had almost 1 gram, that's a large amount of sodium, less than the group that didn't use that intervention, suggesting, just as you say, Keona, we could do better.
Mm-hmm.
We can do better in how we teach, how we talk about it, taking advantage of culture and dietitians and the things that are necessary to make long-term behavior change.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we got some ways to go with that, but hopefully that's helpful. And our last research that matters is about this diagnosis of diabetes in middle age. Maybe a male doctor who's 53. I don't have diabetes, but that would be the right age. And is this going to be a problem in later in life? Do we think, I just go about treating my diabetes? Or is a lot of the memory problems that we sometimes say is due to Alzheimer's, could it be due to this long-term diagnosis of diabetes?
I think this is what the article is suggesting, that getting a diagnosis of diabetes or high blood pressure, one of those chronic illnesses, in the age of 40 to 64, you're at risk, just like anyone else with a brain, of getting dementia. And the memory problems that come from these diseases, or the link that they're making, is that you're having vascular events, so clots or decreased oxygen to your brain, and having many strokes cause in the areas that deal with memory. And I think what this is saying is that having a later diagnosis and having poorly controlled diabetes or high blood pressure puts you at increased risk, just like a genetic history of Alzheimer's disease.
So the key here, just like a lot of other things we're talking about, is lose that weight, get off your medicine, cure your diabetes, lower your blood pressure, all of these things here. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters, Keona. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to be talking with Dr. Scott Lawrence, assistant professor at UNC's Department of Ophthalmology and director of the glaucoma research program in the division, about glaucoma and preventing blindness. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Keona Gillette. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Kiona Gallette. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Scott Lawrence, Associate Professor at UNC's Department of Ophthalmology, about glaucoma and preventing blindness. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Dr. Lawrence, it's really such a treat to have you here. And I think Christy Page, who's our normal co-host, and I want to thank again Kiona for filling in today. We were just amazed that we had never done a show on glaucoma. So we're so excited to have you here. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became an eye doctor and so interested in really being a national expert on glaucoma.
Sure. Well, in my earlier life, I was involved in international health, in organizing teams of doctors to go overseas, primarily in sub-Saharan Africa. And I was doing relief and development work as far back as the mid-90s with the whole Rwanda and Congo conflict. And in subsequent trips overseas, you know, one of the things that struck me was that eye health and blindness in particular was a huge global problem. And so I had a little bit of an interesting trek into medicine. I went to medical school at the age of 32. With a clear focus that I wanted to be involved in an element of health that had global implications. And so as I went into medicine, one of the things that struck me was the issue of blindness. And I knew very early on there was actually a really important survey in around 2002 when I was doing my studies by Prevent Blindness America that found that blindness was the third ranking issue that patients are afraid of behind cancer and heart disease.
Wow.
And so it's something that's on a lot of people's consciences, and it's a really important issue, and I felt like it was worthy enough to give my professional life to.
Great. Well, thank you. Yeah. How do you find that your work in Rwanda and the Congo affects the work that you do today for our community here in Orange County?
Well, I think that, you know, the interesting thing about that experience was at the time that I got involved, and I was a young person at that time, was that it was chaos and people were desperate for answers. And I think as a physician, and you all can probably relate to this, that at times it is chaos because each individual patient's situation is different and unique, and it requires creative thinking and sort of moving on the fly a little bit. But it also, you know, requires a lot of planning. And so a lot of what we do is, when we make investments of our lives, is to say, how can we make a difference? How can we move the bar so that we can improve the health of our patients long term?
Sure. You know, we were talking last week, Kiona and I, with Dr. Anthony Vieira about high blood pressure as the silent killer. Mm-hmm. And the way I know glaucoma, as somehow I think of, has kind of like the silent blindness that people may not know that they have it. Tell us what glaucoma is, and is that impression of mine right or wrong?
Well, it's exactly right. In fact, Dr. Vieira and myself are involved in collaborative work looking, because there are such similarities, and these issues are somewhat related, but it is silent. So for most patients, and in fact, studies have shown that in the United States, about 50% of people who have glaucoma don't know it. And those rates are even higher in the developing world, as high as 90% of people who have glaucoma. So it really is a silent condition. So most people don't have any symptoms.
And what is glaucoma? Let's just start at, you know, basic glaucoma 101.
Sure. So, you know, glaucoma is a neurodegenerative disease. And if the way I talk to about patients, I say, you understand that in the brain there's nerve cells, neurons. And they say, yes, I understand that. Well, think of the eye as the same way. So the eye has nerve cells as well, and we call them retinal ganglion cells. Glaucoma is a disease that causes the death of retinal ganglion cells. And it has a number of risk factors. The most prominent risk factor and the one risk factor that we can do something about is increased eye pressure. Mm-hmm. But it is a symptom and that most patients don't notice. So if you're walking around and your pressure is higher than normal, you may not realize it, and that's a concern.
Well, how does one get screened for having high eye pressure?
So probably, you know, education is really important. And one of the things that I think that is a huge advantage in the United States is that we are doing a better job. And a lot of that is due to the work that people like you, Adam, and Kiona do in your primary health practices, which is to look at family history. So people who have a family history of glaucoma, either usually a first-degree relative like a parent or a sibling, your risk, if you have that, is about 5 to 10 times higher than people without glaucoma. And I guess the natural question is, why is that? And the real answer is that it is a genetic condition. For most people, it's not a single gene. It's multiple genes, so it's a little bit complicated in that sense. But it does tend to run in families. And so if you have a family history of glaucoma, then it's really important to be examined by an eye doctor.
So I have a mother who has glaucoma, a father who had glaucoma. Oh, my goodness gracious. I'm probably a pretty darn high risk of developing glaucoma. But like high blood pressure, when we were talking to Dr. Vieira, you can have two parents who have both have high blood pressure, and you can modify some other things in your diet or exercise to lower your risk. Can we modify that genetic risk? Is there things that I could or should be doing that could lower my risk of developing glaucoma?
Well, certainly, that's a good question. You know, certainly your overall risk modification through exercise and eating well, I think, does make a difference, but it doesn't necessarily lower your risk. So it is important to get screened.
So it's good for high blood pressure, but not necessarily for glaucoma pressure
problems.
Okay. So we don't. Is there anything we know that can lower your risk of glaucoma?
We don't. And one of the things to keep in mind is that, like a lot of conditions, it is age-related. So the risk goes up over time. And so especially in white Americans, age over 60 is a risk factor. In African Americans or patients of African descent, age over 40 is a risk factor.
And so let's say my mother or my grandfather was found to have glaucoma. What are some of the treatment options that they can go through?
Right. So there's been a lot of developments. If you went back about 25 or 30 years ago, there weren't a lot of new treatments. And over the last 15 years or so, there's been a huge development in medical treatment, so relatively non-invasive treatment for glaucoma. In fact, there was a National Institute of Health study that led to the production of a new type of glaucoma drug, which is a protein that naturally exists in the body that can be used in a drop form. And that in most patients will drop the eye pressure in the range of about 20% to 40%. With just a single treatment, a daily treatment. So it could be as simple as an eye medication that could be put in one or two times a day.
Which is a lot better maybe than, I mean, I don't know, what did people do 40 years ago when they didn't have this? Anything?
Right. So they did have some medications that had a lot of side effects and that were not tolerated very well. And then a lot of patients were treated surgically.
And then how do you make a diagnosis? Because, again, this isn't one of those things we can take one of those home blood pressure cuffs and attach it to our eye and check that, right? This isn't a do-it-yourself at home. Or is there? Can you do it on your iPhone?
Right. Not yet. I hope so. I hope we get to that point. And certainly we're looking at home monitoring as a possibility. In fact, one of the studies that we're doing with Dr. Vieira involves putting a contact lens on the eye that can measure eye pressure over a 24-hour period.
Wow.
Now, it's a thick contact lens. And patients are pretty happy to have it removed the next day. So it's not necessarily for everyone, but I think that's where we're moving for the future, yes.
All right. Well, we need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Scott Lawrence, Associate Professor at UNC's Department of Ophthalmology, about glaucoma and preventing blindness. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Kiona Glett.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Keona Gillette. We've been talking with Dr. Scott Lawrence, Assistant Professor and Director of UNC's Glaucoma Program, about preventing blindness. And Dr. Lawrence, I guess right before the break, we were just getting into a little bit of diagnosis. And while that iPhone app isn't quite there yet, you do diagnose it in the office. What are the terms that people talk about when they talk about the pressure of the eye? And is it just one type of glaucoma?
Right. So glaucoma comes in a number of different varieties. And in terms of big categories, there's open-angle glaucoma, meaning that the drain part of the eye, the tissue where the fluid normally drains, is open. And there's angle closure or closed-angle glaucoma, where that drain is narrow or closed, which makes sense that the pressure might go up if you close the drain. The pressure, you know, varies by population, but we know that the average in the United States is about 16. And about 95% of the population fits into a range of about 10 to 21. So if you're outside that range, that makes you a glaucoma suspect, if you will, and it's important to be evaluated for your risk of developing glaucoma.
Can it be too high or too low and both be glaucoma, or is it only if it's too high?
Really, for most patients, it's too high. And that's a relative term. What's high for one patient and one person might be different for another person.
So outside of blindness, and you know, I'm assuming that blindness is on the later end of the illness, what kind of symptoms can I have now? Right, I know we talked about it being silent, but is it painful? Will anyone have discomfort from it?
Right. So most patients with open-angle glaucoma have very little symptoms early on. Most of the vision loss, the way that the eye is designed, if you will, most of the vision loss initially is peripheral vision, and that's one of the things that we test and measure in the clinic.
Meaning
the outside vision. The vision, if you're looking straight ahead, you know, from the outside versus your central vision or when you're looking straight at something. So you may not notice it. If there's a difference between the eyes, you know, one may notice that. And for patients with angle closure, sometimes there are symptoms of pain. So blurry vision associated with pain can be, you know, a warning sign for glaucoma, certainly for those patients.
So you mentioned previously about medications, and I know some of my patients and family members who have glaucoma, they're not just on a single eye drop. They're on multiple eye drops. Help us understand how you go from that single eye drop to multiple eye drops. Is that analogy of treating high blood pressure? You need more than one medication for a lot of people. Is it the same or is it different?
Right. So sometimes it's redundant. If a pressure is high enough, then it takes more than one drop that may be doing the same thing. And a lot of these drops work by decreasing the production of fluid in the eye. So the eye is a closed system that's always producing fluid and always draining fluid. So sometimes we cut off that production, the faucet, if you will. Some of the drops work by opening up the drain and helping the outflow of the eye to function better. Oftentimes I have many patients who are on sometimes 2, 3, or 4 medications, and that can get quite complicated. And that's a whole issue in and of itself is compliance with therapy and the ability to tolerate taking that many medications. And that's led to looking at some newer treatments. There's a whole sort of new field of glaucoma where we're investigating the use of lasers, the use of shunts and other devices that bypass the normal physiology of the eye to create a lower pressure that can be sustained for years to come.
And how do you determine whether you're a good candidate for laser therapy or surgical therapy?
Right. So being evaluated by an ophthalmologist, mm-hmm. medical doctor, is important for this. And for most patients, it's the open-angle glaucoma patients who are the stand the most to benefit from laser treatment. I do probably 1 to 2 dozen laser treatments per month, with very good outcomes. And there was a recent head-to-head study, a very good trial, that looked at the best medicines that we have versus the laser, and they were equally effective with an average pressure reduction of about 30% from the starting pressure.
I mean, I imagine a lot of people get really scared. You know, thinking about losing your vision is one of the more scarier things. And you mentioned cancer and heart disease, but I think for a lot of people, that sight is the avenue. And you're saying they couldn't go blind. How often does that actually happen when you are treating people? Are you reassured, I'm under treatment now, I'll be okay if I just do what you tell me?
Well, you know, certainly one of the reasons I went into the subspecialty I went into is I really love having relationships with patients, and so follow-up is really important. I see my patients usually, you know, every few months, and so it's important to continue that follow-up. And we monitor carefully progression of the condition. So we're doing visual field testing. We're measuring the optic nerve health itself. And so we are quick to step up treatment if we sense that there's any progression of the condition. But it is a serious health risk. And right now in the U.S., there's about 3 million people, close to 3 million people with glaucoma, and about 120,000 blind from glaucoma. So that makes it a huge public health issue for our country.
And for our patients that, or our listeners that are suffering from glaucoma, do they need to go to an eye doctor or ophthalmologist who specializes in glaucoma, or can I go to any eye doctor?
Well, I think initially it is important to be evaluated by a specialist if possible. Sometimes when patients are really doing well, when things are stable for quite a while, then they might be followed routinely by their normal eye doctor, and then occasionally see a specialist just to make sure things are moving in the right direction.
You know, we're talking with Dr. Scott Lawrence, assistant professor in the UNC Department of Ophthalmology and director of the glaucoma program at University of North Carolina. Dr. Lawrence, you know, you started off talking a little bit about international work and your passion. And I remember doing some volunteer work myself in Haiti, and just the simple thing of bringing glasses and letting people see that couldn't. But the threat of losing your vision. So if it's such a big problem in the United States, what about in the rest of the world that we're in developing countries? What's the hope? Where's the research? What do we need to be investing in? Because that seems to me that's got to be where a lot of the future also has to be.
Well, it's a huge issue, and it's close to my heart. And I travel internationally with a focus in East Africa, and particularly Ethiopia. In the developing world, globally, there's about close to 80 million people with glaucoma, millions blind. And so it's a huge issue. I mentioned earlier that about 90% of the developing world don't know they have glaucoma. So identifying those patients through education, finding screening, developing instruments that can detect glaucoma cheaply and quickly is really, really important. And then developing new treatments that have a more permanent change in eye pressure are really, really important, because right now many of these countries have very little in the way of laser treatment. They have very few medications, and much of the population lives in rural areas. Mm-hmm. So having surgery comes with a certain amount of risk when it's difficult to follow up. So it is a huge, huge issue that we're dealing with and trying to find new solutions.
And I know that there's been some research on prevention, and there have been some trials of vitamins and some other things. Christy and I talked about this on some other shows. Unfortunately, some of that's not been positive trials, negative, that hasn't worked. Mention, if you could, about any research into prevention, because ultimately that has to be where we put, again, some more resources, I think.
Right. So, you know, in for instance, for comparison, in macular degeneration, there have been a number of trials, and there's actually one trial that's recently just been completed looking at different forms of vitamins, different forms of antioxidants that have been shown to slow the progression of macular degeneration in a good number of patients. And that's made a huge contribution to that area. In glaucoma, we really haven't had that. But one area that has been developing is the whole issue of genetics. And one of the things that we've been focusing on is how do we protect the nerve cells of the eye so that even though you have these risk factors, they don't die and they don't continue to fall away. And so that's been an active area of research, and we have a number of multi-center consortia trials where we're doing whole genome scanning and looking at the genes that seem to be playing the biggest role in glaucoma progression.
Very good. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Lawrence. You've provided us and our listeners with really great information about glaucoma, the various types, the treatment options, and even sprinkled in a little bit of your international work, and I'm really excited to see kind of what the research you're doing shows.
That's a quick question. Where can our listeners get more information?
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us a link or two that we can put up on our website for people? Because I know people are going, you don't want everyone not right. to you at home on your cell phone. Where can I get more information?
Well, I do give my number out, my email out pretty frequently. But unci.org would be a local site. And then the Glaucoma Research Foundation has a website, which is great because it gives facts on where to get treatment, what needs to be done, and also the new developments in research that patients, you know, really want to know about.
Well, there you guys have it. This was with Dr. Scott Lawrence, associate professor at UNC's Department of Ophthalmology, about glaucoma and preventing blindness. Please check out those websites that he's provided. And coming up are house calls, and we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Keona Gillette.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Keona and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first house call question.
A neighbor of mine has throat cancer, which originated in his tonsils. He was told by a surgeon that his tonsils could not be removed as a form of treatment. Why is this? To me, if you remove the tonsils and the cancer is not spread, the problem is solved, right?
This is a very interesting question. You know, from my understanding is that, you know, if your disease process is more advanced, that surgical options may not be afforded to you, but things like chemotherapy or radiation might be very good options. You know, and one thing might be for your neighbor to maybe sit down and have another discussion with his doctor so that he's fully understanding the extent of his disease.
Yeah, and this is a really tough situation. Mm-hmm. And Keona and I, we and all of our family doctors and primary care physicians, we're sad about this, and this is not an easy thing. And the undergoing the treatments that are available, which would maybe chemotherapy and radiation, because depending on the staging, this can affect both the lips and the tongue and the back of the throat where the tonsils are, heading on down into the voice box and even going down. So there's a lot of different areas that can impact. And my guess is, just like you said, Keona, that this is a little bit beyond where they would probably do based on the staging, one of those more advanced stages. But, you know, sometimes it's worthwhile, if in question, getting a second opinion and getting as much information. You have got to become almost as much of an expert as anyone.
Yep.
When it's your loved one or your friend. So good luck with this. Thank you for that really sensitive question, and we wish you and your neighbors the best of luck. Let's listen to our very next house call, Erica.
I'm a 50-year-old woman who was diagnosed with cancer in my left breast. Currently, the cancer is not metastasized, and my surgeon believes a lumpectomy instead of a mastectomy will rid the current cancer from my body. I never thought I would get breast cancer, as I'm the first woman in my family to receive this diagnosis. I am toying with the idea of asking my surgeon to do a double mastectomy. My reason for this is that I'm married and had children later in life, and I have a young family that I want to be around for. What are your thoughts?
Well, that's a good question, a difficult question, and I'm sure one that a lot of listeners and their family members, when they get a diagnosis of breast cancer, would think about.
Mm-hmm. Very true, especially that you have young children in a family to think about. And I hear that you want to be there for them for in the long run, like you said. You know, I think there are a lot of treatments that are now more advanced, and a lumpectomy, which is removing the focus of the cancer, is a great option versus the mastectomy. And there are some cases where a total mastectomy, which is removing all of the breast tissue, is a better option. But in both circumstances, there are risk and benefits.
And sometimes even though you are the first one in your family, you may or may not decide to undergo some genetic testing. Mm-hmm. that may influence, because if you were at high genetic risk for one reason or another, you might decide to have a double mastectomy. Mm-hmm. That's not what most doctors would necessarily recommend for this particular case. But you know what? It is your health. It is your body. That does eliminate that risk of future breast cancer, though it is not an easy operation. And so I think this would be an individualized case. It's not the most unreasonable request, but it's not something that we would necessarily recommend because it's beyond what's medically indicated.
Yeah. And again, this is a great conversation to have with your cancer doctor to kind of weigh those risks and benefits and kind of individualize your care.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I am a 48-year-old male who recently noticed blood in my semen. My wife is worried and thinks I should be seen by a doctor. I do not feel any discomfort whatsoever. Should I see a doctor? I would really appreciate your thoughts on what this could mean.
Yeah, you should see a doctor. That's the short answer here. Not because we're worried about cancer in this particular situation, but just because this is a longer conversation to have with your doctor, and you're worried, and I would be worried too. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Hannah?
And that pretty much sums it up. It can be as simple as a one-time occurrence and, you know, it never happens again. It could be due to infection. It could be due to angry tissue in the male tubes and pipes, you know, or it could be, you know, something serious like cancer. But like Adam is saying, this is a great conversation to kind of sit down with your primary care doctor and discuss those options.
And what we call this is hematospermia. That's a fancy name. Blood in the sperm is the lay kind of description. And most times that's due to sexual intercourse and the trauma as a small blood vessel breaks. It can be due rarely to prostate cancer. So if it were to happen several times and not an association with intercourse or around that time, then, you know, that would be or masturbation even. That would be the sort of thing that would make it more serious. But in general, because you're going to be worried, you can have your doctor. They can do a small test or evaluation and go from there. Great question. Thanks so much for it. Eric, what's our very last house call?
I'm a 57-year-old woman who recently went for blood work because I'm tired all of the time. My blood work came back normal. Could you recommend vitamins available that could boost my energy, preferably the ones that would work for someone with a sensitive stomach? I would really appreciate your thoughts.
This is a great question and actually coming right at a great time. They recently published some research on whether or not multivitamin use in the everyday person is good or if it shows any benefit.
Big national study.
Yes, huge. And it's shocking to us primary care doctors because that was on our list of things to recommend. And the study shows that it actually doesn't add any additional benefit. So I think your question is a great one. I think there are some things that you can do, though, to help improve energy, that being adjustments in your diet, increasing more fruits and vegetables, decreasing carbs and fats. And another great thing is daily exercise, 30 minutes of aerobic exercise at least 5 days a week. You'd be surprised how much energy you get over time. And a good quality night's rest really goes miles away, you know.
Kiona, I am going to come see you because I need to be doing more of all of those things. Those are great suggestions there. There's something called that glycemic index, which helps you regulate the types of foods you eat also and things that are much more likely to push your sugar way up and then drop real down. If you were going to take any vitamins, it may not be your energy, but a lot of people may, if their vitamin D level was low or maybe calcium, may not give you more energy. There and this idea of a graduated exercise. Don't go from A to Z. Start up gradually and gradually build up your energy level. So lots of things you can do. May not be a quick fix, but it will certainly help. Yeah. Well, we hope that we've answered the questions that are important to you. And if you have any comments, you can send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. Our guest today, Dr. Scott Lawrence. And I'd like to really thank my guest co-host today and last week, Dr. Kiona Gallette. Thank you so much for joining us, and we thank all of you for joining us on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Kiona Gallette. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.